Welcome to MoneyWeb Now. Business news every morning.
It's Monday, 26 April. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you recorded and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. My team and I are taking the long weekend, so we recorded the show last week, so no headlines, no markets, no polls. You're going to be chatting with Keith McLachlan from Integral Asset Management, looking at Sabvest specifically, but also holding company discounts more generally, and then chatting with Mohammed Nala, digging into structural inflation, productivity gains, and what he considers to be the all-important PCE, which is what the Federal Reserve is watching. MoneyWeb Now brought to you by Orbvest, a global real estate company that has a hyper-focus on acquiring stable, income-producing medical buildings in the USA. Investors use Orbvest's online platform to invest directly into low-risk commercial real estate, primarily in the healthcare niche, in the USA, from as little as $5,000.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
I'm chatting with Keith McLachlan. He's investment officer at Integral Asset Management. Keith, appreciate your time today. I want to talk holdcos and discounts. But before I do, I know you've just done a chunky valuation on Sabvest. They're a holding company, Chris Seabrook's company. But in your research, you came across some astounding sort of returns. Typically, a holdco, we could kind of look at it against a unit trust. And you compared it in terms of costs and performance. And Sabvest came out 100 miles ahead.
So first of all, comparing investment companies, unit trust is an horrific comparison.
We're
comparing apples and oranges. But for a moment, suspend belief and facts and just consider that if you're an investor who doesn't want to make equity decisions yourself, you can give your money to a discretionary manager. Now, the traditional route in South Africa is a unit trust. So you go and allocate your money to a general equity unit trust. But what I'm saying is that, in fact, holdcos or these investment companies that sit with permanent capital themselves often have underlying portfolios that are ultimately discretionary choices of equity investments. So, in fact, how can we compare whether they're doing a good or bad job? They don't publish fact sheets. We don't know what their benchmarks are. Well, they don't have benchmarks. So, in fact, if I consider this as a discretionary investor, well, outsourcing a discretionary decision to an external manager, there are possibly actually two routes into this. It's not just general equity unit trust, but, in fact, you can compare the track records of those versus investment holding companies. So that's a long way around, but Sabvest stacks up really, really well when we compare that. If you take their growth in their net asset value over 5 years, 10 years, and 15 years, and you compare it in the CISA General Equity Unit Trust category, not versus the average, but versus the literal best unit trust over each one of those periods, it beats each one of those over and by a significant margin. And in fact, we take it a little bit further and you compare the central costs on Sabvest as a percentage of net asset value, you arrive at effectively what is the carrying cost of that and of managing that portfolio. It's kind of the equivalent of the total investment cost of a unit trust. And in fact, if we go and compare the costs of those absolute best in that category unit trust over those time periods versus Sabvest. Sabvest, in fact, is run more efficiently and is much cheaper. And that's really the summary.
Yeah, and you mentioned permanent capital, and that's a big thing. The thing with the unit trust is that if I've put my 1,000 rand in and I want it back, that asset manager's got to go sell shares to liquidate that 1,000 rand. He's got some cash holding, but, you know, more or less. The permanent capital, if I don't like what Chris Seabrook at Sabvest is doing, well, I sold my Sabvests. And yes, you know, Chris might care because of the share price, but he doesn't have to tweak his portfolio.
So you touched on a very important difference, permanent versus temporary capital. Unit trusts are entirely temporary capital.
Yeah.
So when buying an investment, you might be forced to sell it at an inopportune time, whereas investment companies, holdcos, don't necessarily have that problem. Unless they have central debt, which can be a problem,
sure.
But typically they don't. There are some other differences. unit trusts have mandates, and you can take the best, and a mandate is effectively a legal contract between the fund manager and the unit holder to manage within a specific universe or style, or there's a whole series of rules. Now, you can take the best fund manager in the world, and you can give them the most restrictive mandate in the world, and the mandate will win. So whereas holdcos and investment holding companies, they may have strategies, they can change them. Those aren't necessarily legally binding contracts.
Gotcha.
And in fact, they have a huge, with the added benefit of not having to worry about liquidity, because they've got permanent capital, they can also deploy it in a far more creative manner, being far more opportunistic in that sense. And that also creates a very large differentiating factor.
Back to SEPVEST, the deep discount to NAV, although since you've put your report out, it has narrowed quite substantially. The one thing that strikes me with SEPVEST is they've got some listed, Metrofile, I think that's their primary listed. Most of their assets are actually unlisted. So one of the benefits here is I can get investment into companies that I can truthfully only access via SEPVEST. Whereas, for example, with Remgro, I'm getting, you know, the medicals and the banks, which I could frankly get in the market.
Sure. So there's pros and cons about unlisted versus listed. And you touched on one of the pros. Now, SEPVEST has 89% of its NAV invested in unlisted investments. And it typically is the only public route into these investments. So if you want access to the investment, SEPVEST is the only place you can get it. That's a pro, as opposed, we can literally go and buy the majority of HCR's portfolio and Remgro's portfolio. We can more or less reconstruct those within our own stock brokerage accounts. But the pro of having a listed portfolio is we don't need to value it, because in fact that's what the market's done.
Yes.
So you have a lot more confidence in NAV as opposed to an unlisted valuation. If you go have a look at African Rainbow Capital trading at approaching a 60% discount to its NAV is predominantly unlisted. And I would argue that a large component of that discount is the market not trusting what that NAV is. SEPVEST, I believe, is a little different given its long track record with these companies. And in fact, you can track their valuations over time, and there hasn't been multiple expansions. In other words, this has been driven by profits, which is very real growth in NAV.
Yeah, and African Rainbow Capital, I mean, they've also got the fee structure, which I think a lot of the market, myself included, don't like. But also they've got, you know, Rain and Time, two of their biggest assets, are still in ramp-up stage. And valuing those is immensely difficult. But we have seen, I mean, I look at Remgro, which used to trade at a 15 to 20% discount. It's mostly listed. You know, in results earlier in the year, it was trading around a 40% discount. The part of me says, hang on a sec, I can, if I like the bank assets and the Mediclinic assets, this is a discount way in. But the market over the last year or two or so has taken a fairly jaundiced view of holdcos generally.
So, at Integral Asset Management, we're quite a big fan of buying things at large discounts, particularly when you have comfort in the underlying. So historically, I would argue that these discounts were driven by a combination of holdco costs, so you can present value that negative cash flows and arrive at effectively a discount, which is the added layer of cost. Then it's coupled with trust and valuations. Remgro is a good example of, we don't need to have much trust and valuations. A large portion of them are listed.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final thing coupled is what I call management alpha. So if this was a fund manager, it would be, what was your track record? How much alpha did you generate relative to benchmark? So Remgro is a good example of, their assets over a long period of time have not actually performed very well. And all of that combined, and you arrive at either a discount or a premium. And if you go back to PSG a number of years ago, in fact, at certain periods it traded at a premium to its net asset value. Now that, in my opinion, was driven solely by the market attributing value to management alpha. Like Remgro's might be the opposite, but at the same time, there is a point where that's just too much. And I think this part of the market has been shunned for so long that it's created these sort of opportunities. So I agree with you. I don't think Remgro should be trading at that.
Yeah, but I like your argument there. It's a vote on management, because certainly, as you say, I mean, I remember when PSG was about 10 or 15% above NAV, and PSG were like, I mean, they issued scrip. They thought this was absolutely crazy. And then sometimes, you know, there's others like Zeta, which are just like so small and sort of you can't quite figure it out. Although they are, you know, nice maybe in the agri space, but we'll leave it there. That's Keith McLachlan, investment officer, Integral Asset Management. Keith, appreciate the time.
You've worked hard to accumulate wealth, but with these uncertain times, how can you preserve and grow your wealth in a safer place? Offshore, while earning regular quarterly dividends in US dollars. The solution is here. Hundreds of investors from across South Africa are investing in specialized medical real estate in the USA, sourced by a highly skilled team who make it easy for you. Orbvest SA, an authorized FSP. Visit orbvest.com.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting with Mohammed Nala, he of monos.com, moe-nose.com. Mohammed, really appreciate your time today. Chatting, I want to talk inflation and not the, is it, you know, what's driving it right now. I want to kind of take that sort of step back to the big picture. And in fact, to go back to the 70s when there was double digit inflation, particularly in the US, structural inflation, they called it. Correct me if I'm wrong. Structural inflation, say inflation is 15%. I go to my boss. I want a 15% salary increase. He gives it to me. She gives it to me. They, of course, then just increase the price of the service or the widget by 15%, and inflation kind of becomes baked into the system.
Yeah, thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me on the show. I mean, it's not often someone asks you to go and look at inflation over the much longer term. And I guess I quite like that, because we need to view current circumstances in the context of history. You know, they say history doesn't repeat itself, mm-hmm. but it rhymes. And a lot of people seem to have forgotten that, you know, we had, let's go even further back. You know, if you go back into the 60s, and we talk US inflation specifically here, you had inflation nicely within kind of the single digits, 1.5%.
Yeah.
And then slowly it started to kind of, you know, unravel. Then we had 1971 happen. And obviously, you know, the gold standard disintegrated at that stage. And then we had inflation rocketing up. And in the U.S., in 1970, I believe it was 74, you had inflation, rise into the double digits for the first time in a very long time. And we're talking post-World War II. It then tamed and then ratcheted up even further until levels of around the mid-teens in the 1980s. Now, there was a gentleman called Volcker who was the Fed chair at the time, and he fought inflation very hard. That's when he had a period of much, much higher interest rates in the U.S. as he really tried to battle inflation. But going back to your original question, how does structural inflation become baked into the system? It's exactly as you've indicated. It's essentially the wage price spiral, as is called in economic terms. And that's because as inflation ratchets up, labor goes in, they demand much higher wages. They maybe get wage settlements in excess of inflation sometimes, and they think they're a lot better off. But that is a transient and short-term benefit that labor tends to gain, because, again, capital then looks at this and says, we've got to bake this into the price of goods. It gets worked into the price of goods. And over the longer term, empirical studies have actually proven that inflation tends to hurt the poorest of the poor a lot harder. And that's why I'm certainly a supporter of an inflation targeting type of framework that really has been, I guess, the global standard over the course of the last several decades.
Yeah, certainly that inflation target, I mean, everywhere. The US has got 2%, ours is a 3-6% range. And then, I mean, we chatted about modern monetary theory a few weeks back and how they would look to use tax to sort of bring inflation down. The current mechanism is those central banks using interest rates. And that's what Paul Flocker did in the 80s. He raised rates to extremes. And frankly, it worked. It brought inflation back under control. Is interest rates the best of the blunt instruments?
I mean, the jury is still out on the whole MMT discussion, and that's one that we had not too long ago. You know, at the end of the day, I think the reason why a discussion like that comes to the fore is because we haven't in more recent times seen central banks operate with their usual reaction function. We've had massive stimulus come through from global central banks post-global financial crisis. We've had record low interest rates. We even got negative interest rates in some jurisdictions globally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I guess the economic fraternity is still struggling with. Now, remember that the other angle of this is that post-global financial crisis, not only, you had this massive monetary stimulus that came into the system, but the reason it didn't manifest in terms of much higher inflation is because there's this transmission mechanism that looks at something called the velocity of money. Now, to simplify that, it's just when you get the stimulus coming into your pocket, do you save that money? Does it go onto your balance sheet? Or do you actually go out there and spend the money? And does that money move around the economy? That's the velocity concept.
Mm-hmm.
And really, in order to get inflation running, you've got to have both money supply ratcheting up, as well as the velocity of money either staying constant or increasing. And what's happened more recently is that you've had money supply increasing, but the velocity of money has actually declined in order to offset that. And that's why inflation hasn't been a problem thus far. But more recently, certainly in an era of stimmy, as they're calling it in the US, those checks that come out from the US Treasury are actually going into consumers' pockets. And more recent retail sales data suggests that they are actually spending that money. And so if the velocity of money starts to tick up, there is a risk that we will see some near-term inflation start to manifest.
You mentioned that those stimulus checks, as you say, they're being spent. I mean, Americans have been having money is going directly into their hands. If we go back to the 08-09 crisis, the bailouts then, the quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3, that was different because the money went to the banks and it didn't find its way into Main Street so much. It stayed in Wall Street. Hence, we didn't see inflation on the ground. We saw kind of inflation in assets such as, equities.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the missing piece of the puzzle that a lot of people don't focus on is when you look at your conventional inflation measures like CPI or PCE in the US, and we can get into the detail a little bit later mm-hmm. on, but when you look at those measures, they don't necessarily capture the inflation that you're seeing in asset prices. And when I wrote that piece a little while ago on monos.com, just looking at asset prices from the 1970s to where we are right now, equity prices, house prices, they've all risen, but they've risen to the extent that the value of the money has declined. I'm not going to go into that detail right now, but that asset price inflation right now is quite rampant. If you look at housing markets in the US, here in Canada as well, they are at record highs in Canada, for example, in Australia. Those are two markets that never corrected in the global financial crisis. And they are being fueled by record low interest rates. So the trillion-dollar question really is, can these economies even sustain higher interest rates, or would it just really result in such massive pressure on consumers' cash flows and balance sheets that policymakers are now stuck in a jam? And that's maybe why proponents of MMT are saying, we need to consider additional tools like taxation rather than interest rates in order to try and square the circle.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, in those markets, rising rates really would be a problem. What about the idea around, technology? As you say, we've kind of, even in South Africa, we haven't had the double-digit inflation since the 90s, the U.S. since the sort of first half of the 80s under Ronald Reagan, and an argument out there that says the global supply chains, the just-in-time, the technology on the factory floor has helped sort of compress pricing and therefore take inflation out of the system and perhaps permanently as we keep on advancing technology. Is that an argument that makes sense?
I think so. I think it's actually a very valid argument. There are some concerns for me. So let's firstly go back to it in terms of, yes, since the early 80s, mid 80s in the US, you've had inflation come back within double digits and then just continue to trend lower.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's in this nicely managed band. But a lot of that has been as a result of globalization, of the offshoring of global supply chains. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that the world has taken advantage of cheap Asian, predominantly Chinese labor
mm-hmm.
in order to produce the widgets, the iPhones that we require every single day. And that has kept prices nicely contained. In a world where the geopolitical stance of your major powers, China and the US, remains in flux, that is at risk. There is a risk that in the event that relationships between China and the US start to deteriorate, as we're kind of seeing right now, that onshoring of manufacturing may actually result in increase in prices and a tick up in terms of inflation. So it's definitely one of those mega trends one would need to watch, but probably too early to call right now as an outright inflation risk in the near term. But I would say medium to longer term, that risk is definitely there.
Last question. You mentioned the PCE price index. We you know, when we talk inflation in the media, we look at sort of core headline inflation. But you say actually PCE price index is certainly what the Fed cares about.
Yeah, so it's important to make a distinction between them because, you know, a lot of people refer to CPI, Consumer Price Index. That's the terminology in South Africa, even in the US. There are actually two indices in the US that are of importance. One is CPI, and that's because a lot of your benefits, Social Security, is tied to the CPI index. But then there's the personal consumption expenditures. That's what PCE stands for, index. And that's the one that's watched by the Fed in terms of setting policy. Now, they are very similar, but when you look at it over a long time period, like we're looking at it, you know, there's sometimes as much as a divergence of a half a percentage point per annum that compounds over the longer term. So that is material. And the part of the reason behind it is that CPI looks at what consumers spend their money on, whereas PCE tends to look at what businesses essentially do with prices of goods that they're selling. So that's the slight nuance between the two. PCE tends to run a little cooler than CPI. It's why when I see recent prints of US CPI ticking up a lot more, you know, you got to look at the PCE side of the picture. And then one last point I really want to emphasize is that inflation fears right now are because we're seeing near-term data tick up. But remember that inflation is a rate of change. And so for a rate of change to be sustained, it means that prices are going to have to continue escalating at the rates that we're seeing right now in order for inflation to remain sustained. And that's the reason why I'm not in the camp, certainly not yet, in the camp of believing that this inflation bump up is going to be something that is sustained over the longer time. I certainly believe that it could prove transient, mainly because of the type of year that we've had over the course of the last 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, I mean, the April number, when we look back to last April when oil went negative, I mean, we're going to get a giant April inflation number. We'll leave it there. Mohammed Nala from monos.com. Mohammed, always appreciate the time.
MoneyWeb now on the money. Also available on podcast.
The show is brought to you by Orbvest's latest investment opportunity, Medical 32, a multi-tenanted Class A medical office building located in Jacksonville, Florida. For more information, visit orbvest.com. Orbvest SA is an authorized financial services provider, license number 50483. That's it for today. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m., podcast available from 7 a.m. Huge thanks to my team, Eddie, Cordora, Nicole, Matapelo, to you for listening, my guests for their contributions. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. No show tomorrow for Freedom Day. We'll chat again Wednesday.
Listen to the live stream of MoneyWeb Now at the same time every weekday. For more business, finance, and investment news, MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.